Welcome to Valuification of Things, your one-stop podcast on the discussion of value, and especially business value. This is a forum where your host, Sri Sundaram, will be discussing topics on how to quantify value for practically any scenario. Along the way, we will have business leaders and subject matter experts describing their value journey. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this podcast episode.
Hello, I'm Sri Sundaram, your host. In today's episode, we have an established thought leader in the area of business value analysis and modeling. Welcome, Bill. Bill is a former senior economist at Microsoft. As a senior economist within Microsoft Digital, he helped many Fortune 50 customers across the globe with a value conversation. He not only delved in the commercial area, but also actively helped public sector organizations to measure and realize economic value from digital transformation. Before that, he had leadership roles at multiple organizations, including a CFO role at the Polk Company. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Lee.
So I'm glad you're here, Bill. So before we begin into today's topic, which is quite extensive, can you set us up with what you mean by a business value analysis, the basis for today's conversation?
Sure. For most commercial companies, business value analysis is determining how much shareholder value return comes from a new investment. The customers create their own value estimates. Consultants can help them and give them best practice thinking, but the numbers are always the customer. The value estimates are iterative in that you start with general estimates. Usually you know costs, you don't really know revenues, for example. So you start with the initial estimates, and as you progress through the process, you refine those estimates. And as actually, you might launch something as a trial, and you gain a lot of information from that. So the uncertainty, of course, is the very nature of this entire exercise. So it's important to overestimate cost, underestimate benefits, so that you have a pretty realistic return on investment using discounted cash flow. And then you can identify the various risks and figure out ways to manage them.
Thank you for that great explanation, Bill. Now let's talk about today's topic. You know, leaders always talk about leading with business value in every, you know, public discourse. You know, when you talk to business leaders, when you talk to consultants, and you talk to thought leaders, the most often phrase is business value. You know? Mm-hmm. Yet, why do we find senior leaders look at the net present value and the internal rate of return numbers with skepticism? Why don't these business executives who talk about business value all the time walk the talk?
You know, I would say that in most organizations, you have a sponsor bringing forward a business case. For example, it might be the chief marketing officer who wants to invest in a certain marketing program, and they're known to be very good at selling. That's why they have that job. And so CFOs, CEOs tend to be a little bit cautious with those people and try to pare down the numbers or give it a haircut because they feel like they're probably too large in order to get the project approved. And I see that all the time in organizations. The sponsor is trying to do the best they can to get the project approved. I'm not saying they're lying, but they definitely want the numbers to look good. And I think it's really important that everybody be as true to actual cost, actual benefits as possible, because you're just kidding yourself. If you're fixing a number or coming up with a bogus rate of return, you're not doing anybody any good.
What can we do that these value analysis models are credible enough, and you know, so that these CFOs, CEOs, and others, you know, have a greater trust in those value cases?
I think to start with, you have to use the right tools, which are discounted cash flow. If you've got something else going on, then that's not the acceptable tool for any CFO. Secondly, you want to make sure that all of the assumptions and calculations that are in any estimates are very clearly defined. Nothing is hidden. It's all open source, if you will. It's you to inspection and questioning, and you know, what if something goes up or down, what happens? So being able to do sensitivity analysis is important to show the sensitivity results to various business outcomes or contingencies, such as maybe a recession or high inflation, whatever it might be. The more you do that, I think the more the business leaders have confidence in what these numbers are. In the end, they're making the decision on these numbers. And so it's up to them to really challenge these numbers and question them fully until they're satisfied.
I mean, you have done tons and tons of these value analysis and modeling over your career, right? Mm-hmm. So what are some misconceptions about the value modeling process? And you know, how can companies, consultants, and other value givers and value receivers avoid falling into these traps?
I guess the first thing that would come to mind is I often get asked, well, give me a benchmark. I don't know how to estimate that. You must have a benchmark. And guess what? A lot of times there are no benchmarks. You have to create your own. And there are a lot of ways you can go about doing that. That's more than we can cover in this particular podcast. But benchmarks are important to give authenticity to the models. And as I say, being very clear in explanation and being very transparent is also very important. Those are the top two in my mind.
How about the idea of using proxy benchmarks?
Yes.
When there are none?
Absolutely. A proxy is a very good way to go about it because it works until you have a real number you can use, no longer a benchmark, because a benchmark is a placeholder. Yep. You want to eventually replace that with a real number, whether it's a proxy or a benchmark. That's what you want to do.
And that's a great point that you just made, Bill. Replacing the benchmark with an eventual actual number.
Yes.
I mean, that's where most value modelers think that the benchmark is it. That's a great point.
It's a starting point. It's not the end point.
We will be back after this short break.
This episode of Valuefication of Things is sponsored by Valuefy. Valuefy is a free tool that allows you to create business value models. Go to valuefy.net and click download to begin your valuefication journey.
Now, back to the podcast.
So given these in a value case, it's not always numbers, it's not always objective, there's not hard and fast, you know. Think about employee satisfaction. You know, 5 years ago, before the advent of workplace analytics, CFOs would go, that's a soft benefit. I don't know anything about employee satisfaction, right? So how can companies incorporate these kinds of things, customer satisfaction, employee engagement, into their value models? And what are we gaining by even doing that?
You know, a lot of companies follow a balanced scorecard format where the measures that are followed or looked at are in fact satisfaction, productivity, quality, satisfaction for employees, for customers, for vendors, suppliers, for shareholders, all the important constituents. And I think to take, for example, customer satisfaction, I think it's pretty easy to create a linkage between satisfied customers and say market share or adoption of products from a customer and therefore increase in revenue. And again, you're setting up a goal to challenge. If you have more satisfied customers, maybe you'll raise revenues by 3%. And then when you start to measure the satisfaction and measure your rise in sales, you can track to whether you're getting that. And if you're not, you can adjust it or calibrate it to a more realistic number. And the same way with employee satisfaction, it's very expensive to have employee turnover, training, replacement. And if you have satisfied employees, you tend to have satisfied customers. They go hand in hand. Quality is again, very easy to measure, usually, and improvement in quality means less rework and improvement in customer satisfaction. So all of these particular indicators, even though they look like they're not quantifiable, really are quantifiable. And when it comes to a soft benefit, I've heard that my whole career, an economist would say that a soft benefit is very real. If you look at, say, the cost of capital, part of the cost of capital is debt, which is measurable, and the other part is equity. Well, that's an estimate. That's not a real measurable thing, but it's very real because you have to satisfy customers or shareholders in terms of return. And so even the soft benefits are a true economic reality for people.
Going back to this customer satisfaction, employee engagement kinds of factors. Now, a company could argue that, look, the uptick in the bottom line of the company, the revenue or the profit, could be a combination of multiple factors. Then you'll say you can't attribute all of this to employee satisfaction, or you cannot attribute all of this to customer engagement. So how would you go about kind of in that case, you want to make sure you don't double count?
Yes, absolutely. No, that's absolutely true. Business is a very involved sort of simultaneous equation, and a lot of factors impacting revenues, profits, et cetera. I think the best way to look at, say, a revenue gain of 3% or $10 million is to say that comes from many, many factors, some we know, some we don't know. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is take into account maybe 10% of that gain or maybe 12%, some de minimis factor rather than the entire amount, so that we're not loading up on benefits and overstating the return.
Now, in your career, Bill, I'm sure there have been times when your value model was, you know, stupendously accepted and people said, oh, yeah, that's a great one. Let's go do our stuff. And many times, I'm sure, when they said they poo-pooed the whole idea and said, no, I don't believe those numbers, right? So besides the computational skills, besides the, you know, NPV computational skills and the IR skills and those kinds of things, what are some of the other skills and qualities a credible value modeler needs to have? And how does one go about, do this for an aspiring value analyst?
Well, in a way, like life itself, experience counts for an awful lot. People make investment decisions partially based on the numbers, but a lot based on the gut instinct, their own experience. They might look at a fantastic business case and say, I just don't think this is right for us to do. It's not part of our major strategy. It's not a core competency, whatever. Others might say, I know that's pretty flimsy, but this is an important step to achieving some strategy, for example. And so there's a lot of things involved, and you just have to have collective business acumen, understand the various parts and pieces of a business, from making revenues to producing products to delivering services, whatever it might be. There's an awful lot that has to be taken into account. And the smarter you are about all that, the better you are at making an overall judgment and sort of an omnibus decision about the value of the investment case.
So in the value creation process, how can companies balance the short-term and long-term value creation? There are aspects, we talk about Horizon 1, Horizon 2, Horizon 3 kind of things. And so there is the short-term aspect of value. So how does value modeling play into this process?
It's a big myth in business that the market is interested in your next quarter earnings report. It's been proven over 50 years of empirical analysis that that's not true. The market is interested in the long-term return of your company. Certainly the stock price of any of the major tech companies takes into account many, many years into the future, not just the next quarter. When you use something like discounted cash flow, you are in fact laying out period by period, whether it's months, quarters, years, whatever it might be. And I think it's important to go out several years to do the analysis. Typically 5 years is used. 3 or less is not really enough time to gain back an investment. I've seen some companies, the Japanese used to have, this was a long time ago, they used to have 100-year business plans.
Wow.
Toyota, et cetera. And it's like, wow, you can't do that anymore. It's mm-hmm. lucky if you can get away with 5 years. But you do need to go out for a few years to figure out the rate of return. And that balances out the long-term versus short-term.
Thank you for your time today, Bill.
Yes.
And then any final thoughts? As always, your insights into this topic are quite incisive and quite illuminating. So any final thoughts before we sign off for today?
I think the only thing I'd say is get some training, train yourself, get a lot of experience. And Sri, I'm sure if you get questions from people in your community, I'd be happy to help answer them or speak directly to somebody.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. I look forward to having you back here soon on some of the topics that I haven't quite addressed with you yet.
Very good. I look forward to it as well, Sri.
Thank you. So that's it for today's episode. Good. In today's episode, economist Bill Hubble gave us an understanding of business value analysis, why it needs to be iterative. He gave us an example of a business value dashboard, analysis dashboard. We then delved into why, despite being straightforward and objective, leaders are quite hesitant to use the analysis to assist them in making their business decisions. In future episodes, we'll continue to dwell on the valuification of things with other thought leaders and industry leaders as well. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Valuification of Things. I hope you enjoyed it and learned something new. If you did, please share this episode with your friends and family, and don't forget to leave a review. We're always looking for ways to improve and bring in the best content possible. If you want to be featured on this podcast, please drop us a line at podcast@valuification.com.